May the Lord be with you. A few years ago, my son Reese and I went to an athletic event, and we were seated together in the bleachers, and we were right next to one of those aisles that comes up through the bleachers, and there was a gentleman seated right across the aisle from me. And before the game began, we were having a conversation, just a little casual conversation, getting introduced to one another. It was about that time that a very large person walked through on ground level, and they were carrying a bag of something that looked like donuts as they were walking through. And the person seated next to me, in an effort to be funny, said, "Well, looks like that person there has had more than their share of donuts already." Now, I'm not always thinking this clearly, but this particular evening I was thinking unusually clearly. I knew immediately that I didn't want to jump on board the gossip wagon and have fun at somebody else's expense, and I also know that on this occasion that I didn't want to be confrontational. And so I turned to my new friend and I said, "Well, we've all got our thing, don't we?" And it just so happened that there was somebody else seated just a few seats over. I didn't know that he had been listening in on the conversation. When I said, "Well, we've all got our thing, don't we?" this fellow seated a little ways down said, "Boy, now you've said something right there. We've all got our thing, don't we? We've all got our attachments, those things to which our desire has gotten nailed that at first felt like freedom to us because they were pleasurable or helpful in some way, that in a manner of time they become more ruler and enslaver than they do helper to us. We've all got our thing, don't we? Those attachments that with time, with habitual practice, with more and more enslaving, become full-blown addictions. Substances, attitudes, practices that rob us of our freedom and our wholeness. This morning, I'd like to invite you to continue to be on a journey with me as we discuss addiction and grace. This is now the third Sunday that we've been on this journey together, and I've been very moved by some of the things that some of you have communicated, people who have communicated addictions to control or success or pornography or being nice. I've appreciated the honesty of people in our congregation already. And I just want to remind you that, at least from my perspective, I am convinced that addiction is absolutely universal. I believe every human being on the planet has their thing, or probably their many different things. And I need to note right from the beginning that it would be very easy and very temptation and very awful if we were to use a theme like this as a way of diagnosing one another. That would be the worst imaginable thing that could happen as we think about addiction and grace. If you walk away thinking, "Now I know what's wrong with my spouse," or "Now I know what's wrong with my children or my parents or my neighbor," or fill in the blank, then I assure you that any possible good that could come from thinking about addiction and grace would be lost to us. Our goal, remember, our goal as we consider addiction and grace is to be people who are becoming free. Our goal is not to be perfect. Our goal is not to end up 5 weeks from now absolutely free people. That's not going to happen. Our goal is to be on the journey of becoming free. And now, I would like, for the first time, to tell you about one of my addictions. And this is real. My addiction happens to be rather mild one. At least this particular addiction that I want to speak about happens to be a relatively mild one. It happens to be one of the ones that is in the acceptable category within the church, but it is very real, and I want to share with you how it is that I came upon this addiction. I'm going to hint at it very subtly here. When I was in college, being an extraordinarily disciplined young college student, 1 year in particular, I had managed to discipline myself very creatively to not do any work whatsoever on a particular writing assignment until the night before it was due. Now, it takes real discipline to do this, and I was not able to keep that discipline through my whole college life. But this particular semester, I had managed to put off in every imaginable way the kind of research that I needed to do and the writing of a paper that was due the next morning. And being absolutely convinced that the most quality work is produced by tired, burdened people, I stayed up all night the night before this paper was due. I put in the proverbial all-nighter. And it so happened that a couple of my roommates were just as disciplined as me. And so there we were in our dorm, three of us at three different tables, all of us with our typewriters up on the table, and yes, typewriters, not computers, typewriters. In my particular case, a manual typewriter that I pounded out these letters on, and it was getting late and we were tired. And one of my roommates said to me, "You know, Steve, it would probably help you if you would have a cup of coffee." And I said, "I don't drink coffee." And my roommate, who had already had a cup or two already that evening, as I recall, said, "Listen, there are a lot of benefits of coffee, one of which is fresh and minty breath." He said, "Have a cup of coffee, and it will just make you a little bit more alert." So that night, as far as I can remember, I had my first full cup of coffee. And sure enough, 15 or 20 minutes later, after sipping on this cup of coffee, I found that I had a new level of alertness. I was able to stay awake all through the night. I don't remember how many cups I had that night. I do remember before the night was over, I remember one of us saying to the other, "You know, this stuff might be more effective if we just ate it directly out of the can." A practice that, to my knowledge, we did not actually do. It was a few years later, when I was a seminary student, though, when my attachment to coffee, this pleasure that it gave me, began to grow into a habitual practice. In those days, I would walk to school, and on my way in, very often, I would stop at the Ravenshaven, this coffee shop and sandwich place that was right next to the seminary. And some friends of mine and I would gather around a table, and we would each get a cup of coffee, and we would sit down, and we would just chat with one another prior to classes, or maybe right after a class. And it was one of the most enjoyable times of the day for me every day, just being with friends. And the drinking of coffee was associated with being with friends, and I enjoyed the little buzz that it gave me every day. And it wasn't long before I would stop and get a cup of coffee, whether I was meeting with my friends or not. On my way into class, I would just stop at the Haven, and I would get a cup of coffee, and I would go sit in my class. And this practice became habitual for me to this day. It is still part of my practice. I want to talk about my coffee drinking as an example of addiction and the way that my coffee drinking fulfills some of the characteristics that are true of all addictions. The first characteristic of all addictions is what I'm going to call tolerance. By this I mean that you come to need more and more of whatever it is that you're attached and addicted to. It works in very complicated ways. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but our bodies are constantly seeking balance. This is a very powerful thing that goes on in our bodies all of the time. There's a part of my brain that kicks in when I'm tired, and it is supposed to help me become more alert. But there's another part of my brain that kicks in when I need to settle down and become less alert. So when I go to sleep, this part of my brain is supposed to fire, and when I'm needing to get more awake, this part of my brain is supposed to fire. And when I started drinking coffee, unbeknownst to me, this powerful adrenaline was shot through my system, waking me up. And the other part of my brain, the part that is supposed to keep balance, would say, whoa, slow down. And it would start working more powerfully. And so, because this part of my brain was kicking in to cause me to settle down, I found that I needed to drink more coffee to get the same experience. And so, one cup of coffee a day became two cups every morning. Two cups before long became three. It wasn't too long and I was drinking coffee in the afternoon. You know, when you come in right after lunch, you're tired and you need that little pick-me-up. And I remember even at one point thinking, gosh, I'm tired at the end of the day every day. I wonder what would happen if I have a cup of coffee in the evening. And lo and behold, it worked wonderfully. I had a cup of coffee in the evening, and the only problem with that one was the way it woke me up in the evening was also the way it woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. So what I'm describing for you is a process that is true of addiction, that whatever it is, whether it is a substance or an attitude or a practice, whatever it is, we need more and more and more of that thing in order to get the fix that we're looking for. A second characteristic of addiction is withdrawal symptoms. I'll never forget the year during Lent, I decided to let go of coffee through the season of Lent. Now, I had experienced the headaches before. That much wasn't a surprise to me. The next day, after not drinking coffee, I had powerful headaches. I knew that they were going to go away in a day or two. But it was the week or two after that had surprised me. I found myself in a terrible funk, a depression. I had no idea. I hadn't linked it at all to caffeine whatsoever. It was another person in our church in Phoenix who came to me one Sunday morning, and she said, "Steve, is there something wrong?" I had no idea that others could tell that there was something wrong. I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I've just been in a real funk the last week or two." Now, my friend was studying to become a counselor. She was getting her master's degree in counseling, and so she went into her counselor mode. She said, "Well, have you made any changes in your life lately?" I said, "Well, nothing major." She said, "Anything at all?" I said, "Well, I gave up coffee for Lent." She said, "Oh, that's interesting. We were just studying that in my class the other day," she said. "Did you know that one of the symptoms of dropping caffeine is depression?" I said, "I had no idea." And there it was, right in front of me, withdrawal symptoms of this relatively mild addiction that I had developed. Another characteristic of addictions is self-deception. This is where you just get really good at lying to yourself. This is where you say things like, "Oh, I don't have a problem with coffee drinking. It really does give me fresh and minty breath every day. Think of the many ways it improves my social life. And besides, everybody does it." These are the things that I would say to myself. "Everybody drinks it. I'm just doing something that everybody in my culture does." A fourth characteristic of addiction is loss of willpower. And there came a time during my coffee drinking experiences when I said to myself, "You know, I really need to moderate this a little bit. 4 cups a day is probably too much for me. I know it is. It makes me jittery. I shouldn't be drinking this much. I should drop it to 3. I should drop it to 2. I decided 2 cups in the morning is reasonable. And then one day I came in the afternoon and I was very, very tired and I needed a little pick-me-up. And I said to myself, once won't hurt anything." And so, well, anybody want to guess where this went? One of the characteristics of addictions is the loss of willpower. And then the fifth one that I want to mention this morning is very important to us. It is the distortion of attention. What I mean by this is when my deep yearnings, which I've suggested in the weeks previous to this morning, are our hearts longing for God and for God's call in our lives. When our deep yearnings and longings are nailed instead to substances or practices or attitudes or habits, our attention is taken away from the sources that give life and is spent instead on the sources that bring us bondage. Now, I'm telling you the truthful story of my addiction to coffee. This happens to be a substance, but I could just as well have described any of the hundreds of addictions from which those of us in this room struggle. I could have talked about the same process for people who are addicted to being nice, who never speak what they really think and never confront anything under any circumstances whatsoever. I could have talked to folks that are addicted to a particular relationship, expecting a person to meet their life's deepest needs. I could talk to our addictions about trying to please the people around us constantly, or power, or money, or security, or being thin, or potato chips, or the list is 1,000 miles long. What I want to suggest to you this morning is that our addictions are universal, they are powerful, and that they all share in the 5 characteristics that you see before you on the screen. Now this morning, I want to invite you to look with me at the third of these characteristics a bit more deeply. This is powerful and it's important, and especially, I believe, for those of us who are gathered together in this house of worship. I want to talk this morning about the characteristic of addiction that we're calling self-deception. And I want to invite you to look at this powerful characteristic of addiction from the perspective of the passage of Scripture that we read just a moment ago, the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Just as we did on the first Sunday 2 weeks ago when we looked at the story of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden from the perspective of addictions, I want to look at this story this morning from the perspective of addiction as well, and especially the characteristic of addiction that we're calling self-deception. This is, of course, a story that was told to us by Jesus. It is a parable. It is a parable that Jesus told not so that we would get the facts straight about the Christian faith, but rather so that we would see differently, that we would have new kinds of eyes for seeing our lives in the world. And we know a great deal about the two characters in the story right from the beginning. Jesus tells us that this is a story about two people, a Pharisee and a tax collector. About the Pharisee, we know a great deal already. Let's add a piece of fiction to the story. Let's call him Alexander. The Pharisee named Alexander is the member of a Jewish sect that is known for its practice of religious purity. Now, I'm going to ask you for just a minute to put aside your biases toward the Pharisees, if you would. Try to just let go of those for just a moment. Because many of us here are familiar with the Gospels and the many times that Jesus had to confront the Pharisees, I suspect that we've gotten a very false notion of who these folks were. There's a very good chance that if you had to choose from a group of people who would be your next-door neighbor, there's a very good chance that you would have selected a Pharisee. He was a kind of person that would not invade your property. He would never rob from you. He would probably return things to you shortly after borrowing them. He'd be the kind of person who would not overrun your boundaries or mistreat you, because he's a fellow who's really, really committed to purity. He's a fellow that belongs to a religious sect in Israel that believed that the harshness of the times in which they lived, the time of being occupied by the Roman army, the harshness of the times in which they lived, were a part of God's judgment upon God's people Israel. And they believed that the way to get out of this time of harshness was by strict adherence to the Jewish law. Not only obeying the Ten Commandments, but obeying 100 prescriptions related to each one of the Ten Commandments. They would not only not work on the Sabbath, they would decide how many steps you could take on the Sabbath before that was counted as working, and they would always make sure that they stopped one step short of that. This was a group of people who was profoundly religious and really decent human beings, the kind of people that you might want to have next to you. And it so happens that the Pharisees were welcome to pray in the innermost section of the temple. This is important. Now, there was one place called the Holy of Holies. That was the center of the temple, and only the high priest was allowed to go there. But the next realm, the next circle, if you will, of the temple, was where only clean Jews were allowed to go. And by the way, only male clean Jews, pure. And so it is in this section of the temple that the Pharisee is standing on this particular day, and he lifts his eyes up to heaven, and he prays this prayer. Would you go ahead and pull that up for me, Diane? This is the prayer of the Pharisee. God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all I get. Now that's the Pharisee. It so happens there's a second character in this story who is known as the tax collector. We know quite a bit about this fellow too. You've probably heard before as well. The tax collector is what we could probably call a mercenary of the Roman government. This was a Jew. This was a Jewish man who was hired by the Roman government to stand at the head of various roads in the Roman Empire, including the ones in Palestine, and to take tolls, taxes from people, anybody who wanted to walk on that particular road, he would take these tolls. And then the tolls would be given to the Roman government. And oh, by the way, he was only required to give X amount. So if he could raise X plus whatever more, he got to keep the extra. It was a system that was rife for abuse. And this is a fellow who had been abusing the system. He's not welcome in the innermost courts of the temple. He's only welcome in the outer court of the temple, which is the place where even Gentiles, and I'm sorry, even women could go, because in their world, Gentiles and women were considered unclean and ungodly. As terrible and as unbelievable as that may sound, it is true. The tax collector is standing in the outer courts, with the Gentiles and with the women. And the tax collector does not lift up his eyes at all. He beats his breasts, he looks down at the ground, and he prays, God, have mercy upon me, a sinner. And the kicker of the parable, of course, the kicker is the response of Jesus. Here's his response. I tell you that this man, the tax collector, and not this man, I tell you that this man went home justified before God that day. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. In other words, this is the story of a Pharisee who may or may not be named Alexander, and his terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And what makes it a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day for Alexander the Pharisee is that he can name with great clarity all of his accomplishments and all of his good. Like a guy, like a video that is set on a loop, he can name all of his accomplishments and all of his good over and over and over and over again. But Alexander the Pharisee suffers from a powerful case of self-deception. Remember, we're reading this story from the perspective of addiction, from the way that self-deception functions in our lives. And Alexander the Pharisee is powerfully deceived. He does not even know that he suffers from a powerful addiction to judgmentalism. He doesn't even know it. And chances are there are dozens of other things to which he is powerfully addicted, and he does not even know the control that they have in his life. Who knows? I wonder. Is he addicted perhaps to his standing in the community? Is he one of those Pharisees that likes to stand on the corners with his robes hanging long and his prayer shawl out with everybody to see because he loves for people to notice how sanctified he is? Is it possible that he is addicted to people's approval of him, powerfully addicted? He gets such a buzz out of knowing that people approve of who he is. Is it possible that he's addicted to his reputation? You know, there goes Alexander. Someday he's going to be senator. Is it possible that Alexander is addicted, I suspect it is, to his religion, like we talked about last Sunday, religion that doesn't work, religion that is an addiction to the outward styles and the boxes in which we put God and having our ownership over who we think God is and being in control? The problem with Alexander and his terrible, horrible, very bad, no good day is that he is deceived, utterly and completely deceived about what controls him. He doesn't even know it. And this, friends, is the powerful power of self-deception. Very often, self-deception lurks within our minds in such ways that we don't even notice the things that control us. Others around us might be able to note that we are controlling, or that we are workaholics, or that we must do everything that everybody wants us to do, and that we have no energy left for the things that are really important for the way that love really operates. Others around us might notice, but we walk through life blithely, not even noticing, in many cases absolutely unaware of this, of the power of this that controls us. Or we simply lie to ourselves. Well, 5 cups of coffee a day isn't a bit too much. It doesn't affect my functioning in any way whatsoever. Look, everybody vibrates on their way to their office in the morning. And the power of this, of course, is that those of us who are self-deceived, we are not free for love. Here's a funny thing, by the way, about my mild addiction to coffee. There have been times when I have absolutely known beyond the shadow of a doubt that in certain occasions I have not been fully present to certain people. I've not been able to really be there with them and really listen to them because my brain is unclear because I've got too much caffeine running through my veins. I'm just speaking honestly with you. The power of self-deception is that we become blind or lying to ourselves about the ways that we are controlled and enslaved, and we are not free for the love of God and the love of our neighbor. This is the story of self-deception. And then, of course, there is a second character in this story. If it's a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good day for Alexander the Pharisee, for the tax collector, you might say it's the day when all the raindrops are candy bars and ice cream. Oh, what a day. It's the day of days for the tax collector because it's a new day. It's a brand new day. Of the tax collector, Jesus says, justified. Made right with God, exactly where you're supposed to be. And Jesus says this of the tax collector, why? Because he turned his head to the ground and beat his breast and wouldn't even look up at the other people in the temple, and he cried, oh God, have mercy upon me, a sinner. It's a very good day for the tax collector because his failure and his knowledge of his failure and his honesty about his knowledge of his failure have led him to the trailhead of the path of transformation. His honesty has led him to the trailhead of renewal and grace and new beginnings and new opportunities. It is a brand new day in the life of the tax collector. This last Sunday, I asked you to think with me about the gospel of Jesus Christ, not so much as a body of the right information, getting all of our P's and Q's and I's and T's dotted and crossed and lining in the right directions. I asked you to think of the gospel of Jesus less as having all of the right information, and I asked you to think of the gospel of Jesus as an invitation to be on a journey of transformation, a path of renewal, a journey that leads us to be people who are becoming free. And it is this path on which the tax collector is now grounded. It is, believe me, it is the road less traveled. Over the next two Sundays, I want to take a long look at this road that I'm calling grace. But this morning, I want to just begin to drop some hints about where this road is going to lead us. I want to suggest to you that grace is a radically different power than the energies of attachment and addiction. I want to suggest to you that the grace of God is the wellspring of perfect love. The grace of God is that for which the homing instinct of our lives, this longing and yearning that we all feel, that becomes attached to a thousand different things. I want to suggest to you that the grace of God is that for which the homing instincts of our lives is absolutely longing. The grace of God is like the story of the manna in the wilderness, that wonderful story of the manna in the wilderness, in which God, in grace, granted the needs of the people of Israel walking through the wilderness, manna gathered from day to day, which was given absolutely and fully as the gift of God. But we, fearful addicts that we are, we may want to hoard to ourselves the grace that we think we need. We may want to capture it and own it, and like the manna in the wilderness, you simply can't do that with grace. It is a gift that you must trust God to give over and over and over and over again. I want to suggest to you that grace is forgiveness. Oh, and how? But I want to suggest to you that we in the church have gotten stuck in thinking that grace is just forgiveness. Grace is God coming to us in love day after day after day after day. Grace is our communion with God that we get to enjoy that we did not initiate, but it is God's initiative to us. Grace is that which we cannot control, but which comes to us to make us free again and again and again and again. Though we cannot own grace, I want to suggest to you that we can learn to be receptive to it. We can learn to have hearts that are open day after day after day to the divine love that comes to us with presence and with power. I want to suggest to you that grace is not one more attachment that nails our desires and suffocates our capacity for love. Rather, it is the ongoing multiplying of mercy that makes us free. And I want to suggest that you and I can order our lives in ways that we live at the openings of grace in our lives and become less and less and less dependent upon all of those things to which we have become attached. Friends, the wonderful news, is that I am convinced, at least, Every person in this room has been encountered by grace already. We're not talking about something that is out there somewhere. The beautiful world news is, I am convinced at least, every person here, religious or not, has already been encountered by grace at various times in your life. For some, those moments have been so intense and private that you may have never told anyone because you weren't sure what to do with them. It might have been an encounter with beauty that you had one day. A surprise to you, you had no idea that it was coming, but an encounter with beauty perhaps in creation or a piece of art or a piece of music in which you were simply enraptured by beauty in that moment. And it wasn't that you had beauty, it was that beauty had captured you. And there was something about that experience that was so mysterious and powerful that you felt that love was at the very center of it. We're talking about grace. For some of you, it might have been an act of kindness that was given to you by some other human being, perhaps a stranger, somebody you didn't even know. In a moment of your deepest need, there was somebody who was just there. And in the moment, all of it caught you up as being surprising and overwhelming and encouraging. And later, when you reflected on that moment, you found that there was something mysterious about the whole thing. And maybe afterwards, you found yourself describing it as some kind of an angelic encounter. Grace. It might have happened for some of you as a flood of insight, a moment of awareness of the goodness of things. Sometime in your life when you had perhaps been struggling with a great problem that you simply couldn't solve, struggling and struggling and struggling, then all of a sudden, there it was, the solution that you'd been looking for. I love the journal entry of Dag Hammarskjöld, the fellow whose journal called Markings has now become sort of a classic of literature. Dag Hammarskjöld wrote about his struggles day after day, his grappling with life, his struggling to try to find meaning and purpose. And one day in one of his journal entries, he wrote, "I have now become convinced that someone or something has laid hold of me and is giving my life direction." And in later journal entries, he had no trouble naming what that someone or something was. He became more and more comfortable calling that someone or something God, the Father of Jesus. I believe many of us have had these encounters with grace in the hearing of the gospel, the good news about God coming to us in Jesus of Nazareth. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life." And for some reason, there was present in that moment, not the awareness in your head that that is true, but the opening of your whole heart to all that those words speak of and all that many other words of good news speak. I'm convinced that many of us have had that encounter. This morning, and especially in the next two Sundays, I want to point to grace. I want to point to the grace of God that is bubbling up for all of us. That grace that when we develop hearts and minds that are open, we can become surrendered to and open again and again and again. It is that to which the homing instincts of our lives are compelling us. In fact, the longing and the desire is itself the grace of God. We're invited today to a different kind of a journey. Believe me, much will still be required of us, believe me. Those attachments and addictions that I've been speaking of are not going to go away easily. They will yell and scream as we begin to let go of them and surrender to a different kind of power. This different kind of journey is not the way of our willpower. It is not the way of trying harder and harder and harder to get it right. We already know that that's not going to work. But it is living out of a different kind of energy. It is living from the energy of love. It is learning to live from the energy of grace. That grace that we have met in Jesus Christ. Here is a power that you cannot control, that you cannot manipulate to your own ends, that you cannot turn in ways that you decide you want it to turn, but rather here is a grace that comes to you freely to be gathered up and taken in day by day and to which your heart can be increasingly open. This morning I want to invite you again to a very simple response. In just a minute, Pastor Ron and our musicians are going to come and lead us in a beautiful song, a song of surrender to this grace that I've been speaking of. But just as we did last Sunday, I want to invite you to the cross. Remember last Sunday, I suggested to you that the beauty of the grace of God is that those things to which we have gotten nailed, those attachments, those addictions to which we have gotten nailed, those things can now be nailed on the cross. That grace of God that is the trailhead of freedom. This morning as we sing, I want to invite you to one of two crosses. There's one over here to my right, to your left, and behind that cross there's a ledge, and then there's another cross back here at the back, right in the aisle on the way back. There you're going to find the cards that say, bring it on one side. I want to just invite you to turn the card over and begin writing some of the attachments that have nailed you down, that you want to nail to the cross, and that you want to learn to walk in the power of God's grace on the road to freedom. Here's the invitation to us, friends. It is painful, it is hard, it is costly, but the invitation is to be people who are becoming free. I invite you to respond now as Pastor Ron and our musicians lead us.